Good afternoon. Thank the court. I apologize for our being late. We're delighted to welcome students with us from Fond du Lac High School. Would you please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students around the state are invited to come and listen to oral argument, and then we'll have the opportunity to speak with a justice. Now, were you here for having a justice yet? No. Okay. We'll see what we can do for you, okay, because it's ordinarily held at noon. But I'm sure that we can get a justice who will talk to you right after this case. Can you stay? Okay, thank you. We'll take care of it then. you've received materials about the case. You may have engaged in some activities relating to the case. And this is part of an outreach program for teaching about the judicial branch and also listening to questions and comments by people who come. Is anyone in the courtroom in the need of a summary of this case? It's easy to listen if you know what it's about. All right. Before we proceed, let me introduce the members of the court to you. On my far right is Justice Ziegler. Justice Ziegler, can you spend a few minutes after this case with these students?
Gladly.
Good. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice...
Patience.
It's a test, but with a name
patience,
like Patience
Rogenstad, that's why it's hard.
And on the far left, Justice Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our last case for the last 3 days, our ninth case in January. 08-AP-2929, Wendy M. Day versus Allstate Indemnity Company. Arguing on behalf of Wendy Day is Martha Height.
It's a privilege to be here today in front of all of you arguing on behalf of Plaintiff Respondent Petitioner Wendy M. Day. This case involves application of Allstate Indemnity Company's family member exclusion provision. Most typically, family member exclusion provisions apply in the context of lawsuits between two insureds under the same policy. In the context of this particular case, which involves the wrongful death of Wendy Day's daughter, Emma, we are asking for a ruling that the Allstate Indemnity Company's family member exclusion be ruled void pursuant to public policy. In the alternative, we seek a determination that the provision is ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage.
Counsel, do you think we have to overrule Whirlpool and or Shannon to do that?
No, I don't think so. This case falls outside the scope of these particular cases.
Explain how, please. Tell me how.
Well, Shannon v. Shannon involves a really horrific accident involving a 3-year-old child. The child fell into a lake and suffered severe brain damage. In the context of that case, the child, via its guardian ad litem, was suing the parents. This 3-year-old child and the parents were both insured under the same policy, and I think it might be reasonable to conclude that this brain-damaged 3-year-old child would not have been able to bring this suit without the assistance of her parents. So this is precisely the kind of intrafamily situation that gives rise to the risk or concern of collusion between family members. So it's completely different from this particular case.
So that didn't have to do with being receive a benefit from the coverage. You're saying because the parents would have to assist in a lawsuit, that's why the family coverage provision applied in Shannon?
I'm saying that the public policy justifications for a family member exclusion provision would be most notable in a situation where a very young child is suing its own parents for coverage under the parents' insurance policy. And so that is a classic case where the courts have upheld a family member exclusion provision based on risk or fear of collusion between the insureds. The language in that provision would not be the same as this one.
Counsel, let me interrupt you, if I might, at this point, because you're starting off talking about public policy.
Correct.
And our cases are somewhat inconsistent in terms of when we decide to apply or not yet apply public policy considerations. Sometimes we say this is a case that ought to be tried first, and after trial, public policy considerations can then be applied most appropriately. In other cases, we've said, no, we can apply the public policy considerations now. We don't have to wait for a trial. Why should we take one approach as against the other in this particular case? Should we wait for trial, or should we apply public policy considerations now?
Well, most of the situations where public policy considerations are applied after a trial are situations where the plaintiff succeeds in a lawsuit and the defendant seeks to override the decision based on public policy considerations. This situation is different because this is a coverage situation where the goal is to determine whether coverage exists in advance of the trial. In the past cases, what's happened, and this is really counter to what normally happens in the context of a summary judgment motion, the appellate courts have been willing to just plain assume without really knowing that there's a really having a complete understanding of the facts, have been willing to assume that there's a sufficient, if minimal, risk of collusion to be enough to trigger public policy considerations so as to allow application of a family member exclusion provision. This is highly unlikely or highly unusual to have the courts be willing to step in and make assumptions based on very minimal facts one way or the other, but it has had the benefit of making things simple to dispose of in the context of family member exclusion provisions. I think the solution in this case is to look at the situation and see that this situation is different from the ordinary situation involving family member exclusion provisions. This case does not give rise to even the remotest, smallest possible possibility of collusion. It's simply not a case where courts can make this assumption. I think it was stretching the limits, perhaps, to make the assumption in previous cases based on minimal facts, but to go one step further and make the assumption that there's going to be collusion when a bereaved mother is bringing suit against the stepmother for unconscionable negligence that results in death of a child is just plain going too far. Also, most family exclusion cases involve suits between two insureds under the same policy. This case does not involve a lawsuit between the insureds under the same policy. Moreover, it doesn't even involve a suit between family members. So when you look at the situation here where there's no possibility of collusion that gives under these facts, and there aren't involved family members, and there aren't co-insureds under the same policy, I think the court should be comfortable drawing an assumption or conclusion similar to what has been done in the past, only in this case, assuming that there is no possibility of collusion.
Counsel, can I just ask, did you have a chance to finish how we deal with Whirlpool or not?
Well, I've kind of gotten drawn out in another direction by the questions, but...
And good questions are they.
Indeed.
But I think there's a relationship here. In Whirlpool, a direct claim was not brought by the injured daughter against her mother. And so there was no application of the Allstate family member exclusion provision in that case based on a direct claim. Instead, there was a contribution claim. In the contribution claim, really the Whirlpool company was standing in the shoes of the insured and bringing a claim based, the exact same claim that the daughter didn't bring. And these two claims were, it's just really just basically a blatant attempt to do an end around the family member exclusion provision, and the court didn't stand for it. And though it worked pretty hard at it, I would say, in the decision, it managed to come up with at least some possibility of collusion that could be assumed that would be sufficient to justify a contribution claim based on the ordinary concern in those provisions, which is fear of collusion. And so the provision was upheld in the Whirlpool case. This case is not the same. Like I was saying in response to some other questions, first, Whirlpool, you do have at least a remote and conceivable possibility of collusion. Here you don't. In Whirlpool, the negligence was one insured was injured, not killed, but injured by the other insured, and the claim that could have been made directly was for the injuries and damages sustained by the insured. In the context of the contribution claim, it was the exact same situation analysis. The insurance company or the Whirlpool company was trying to get contribution based on the mother's negligence causing injuries and damages to the child. In the context of a wrongful death case, there's a new claim. It's not the same. And the case is brought then for someone outside the family bringing a claim against an insured for their own injuries and damages sustained apart from what was suffered by the person who died.
In a wrongful death claim, who gets the money?
In a wrongful death claim, only someone who goes in front of the court and satisfies and receives a judgment is the only person who can get a claim.
Right. Well, that's always the case. You know, but I mean, no one gets the money unless they actually sue and prove their damages and can recover. So, but in this case, who are the beneficiaries of the insurance money that would be paid if they prevail?
Well, in this case, there is a family member exclusion provision. So there's two potential beneficiaries or claimants who could conceivably bring a claim in this case for the wrongful death of Emma. And that assumes that Clinton Day is not also somehow negligent or responsible for the death. But we don't have that in the record. But if you make that assumption, perhaps he could also bring a claim, assuming the statute hasn't run, assuming his pleadings everything's correct and all his ducks are in a row and everything's proper, he could potentially recover a judgment against his wife, Holly. Now, can he recover under the Allstate policy? No, he can't, because for the simple and ordinary reason that an exclusion provision is applied, and a family exclusion provision is applied just like any other exclusion on a claim-by-claim basis. So we simply say, Clinton Day attempts to bring a wrongful death claim. We read the language. Would any recovery benefit of this coverage, and I would say that's a recovery, accrue directly or indirectly to an insured person? Clinton Day is an insured person. Clause kicks in. Clinton Day is unable to recover for this, the judgment against Holly under his insurance policy. On a claim-by-claim basis, you just insert Windy Day into the same provision, and she can recover. So it's really that simple.
Counsel, I think it's a little more complex. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
I think that you're collapsing, and I think the Court of Appeals collapsed the word, collapsed the claims here. It is not just a matter, this is what I think, and tell me where I'm wrong, will you? It's not just a matter of Clinton bringing a claim or Wendy bringing a claim. The question is, what type of claim? Because in wrongful death, you have two different types of claims. You have a claim that is a survivorship claim, right?
Right.
And that then kind of inures, that's almost analogous in some ways to the Whirlpool case, because that was a contribution claim, but for the injuries and damages of the insured. So one kind of claim you have under 895.043 is a survivorship claim. You know, the other kind of claim you can bring under 895.043 is an individual claim. Nothing to do with the injuries of the daughter. Nothing to do with the damages vis-a-vis the daughter. It is my own claim as a parent, an individual claim, as the parent's loss of society and companionship. So I think both you, and what I heard you right now in your argument, and the Court of Appeals treat this as though it's a wrongful death claim. And there are different kinds of claims, one in an individual capacity and one in a survivorship capacity. And I think the analysis is different. Can you respond to that? Am I off the mark or on the mark?
I believe the Court of Appeals did address both types of potential claims. And in the Court of Appeals, we had both potential types of claim. I think the analysis is potentially different for the two different types of claims. The survival claim creates a much more difficult question.
Yes, and I think in paragraph 12 and 13, the Court of Appeals applies the reasoning to the survivorship claim made by Wendy on Emma's behalf. And I think that's fair enough, I mean, from my perspective. But in paragraph 11, the Court of Appeals seems to apply that same rationale to the individual claim of a parent for loss of society and companionship. Not the injuries and damages, loss of society and companionship. And I think that blurs the two separate claims that are provided for under 895.043. What do you say about that?
I agree 100%, and you said it more concisely and better than I could have. That is one of the areas where the Court of Appeals went astray in its decision. But before this court, we aren't attempting to recover for the survival claim.
Yeah, you're not. You're just
recognizing the difference between the two, and the more difficult question that arises in the context of a survival claim, that would be left for another day. Another case involving different, these are the days, but it will be left for another situation. And it is a harder question. That's why we decided to focus on the issue that we felt was the most obvious and clear in our favor. Does that answer?
I'm not sure whether
I'm answering the question or whether you want me to.
No,
that's
fine.
Went astray.
I was wondering if I was going astray, because I heard you just talking about wrongful death claim, and of course there are wrongful death claims, one as a survivor, one as an individual, and the analysis, at least arguably, for the family exclusion as to whether or not the money would directly or indirectly benefit an insured person can play differently with regard to a survivorship claim, where arguably it would, and an individual.
That's 100% correct, and I'm amiss in being a little imprecise in my language and discussion, but I was assuming in when I discuss a wrongful death claim in the context of this argument that I mean the kind that we are bringing here, which is the mother's individual claim for her own damages that arise out of the death of the child, loss of consortium, and pecuniary damages. So that's different from a survivor claim, which would address the pain and suffering and other problems that Emma went through as a result of this horrible situation.
Counselor, is there any obligation on behalf of the father to bring a wrongful death claim or any other type of claim based on the death of this child?
There's never an obligation for any parent to bring a wrongful death claim based on the death of their child. And many people, I'm sure, would feel that bringing such a claim is going to do nothing more than increase their suffering and bring to mind the terrible circumstances. And many people would rather just stay out of the courts and suffer through the problems on their own without bringing a claim. I can't see any obligation to bring a claim like that.
Is there any tie-in that's either been alleged or established in this claim between the mother's claim, who is divorced from the father, and the father's decision not to bring a claim?
We don't know the circumstances why the father didn't bring a claim, but my assumption would be that had he brought a claim, he would only be able to recover on that claim against his wife, and he chose not to do that. The family exclusion provision in this case clearly would not allow him to recover for his wrongful death claim from Allstate. That would just not pass muster because it would involve a recovery from an insured based on suing another insured. So there was not a lot of motivation
for
him to do so.
He doesn't have a claim under the policy, is your assessment, in regard to the death of his daughter, correct?
He can't recover under the policy based on the application of the family member exclusion provision.
Okay.
He would have a claim against his wife for a judgment.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, how much can she recover? Let's just assume for the moment that the facts are that she might recover $350,000, which is the limit, right?
Is it that or 500?
500,000, I believe.
I'm sorry.
I don't
this
remember
deceased
what the policy
minor.
Limits may
okay.
be at 300.
But her max is 500,000 for minor, 350,000 for not a minor. And she sues. Can she just take it all? And is the damages for each person that sues under wrongful death, or is it for everyone who's entitled to recover for the wrongful death? You know what I'm driving at, obviously.
Well, the father in a wrongful death claim brought by the mother for the death of the child is generally considered a necessary party.
That's what I'm driving at.
And in this case, Clinton Day is a party.
Joined.
Mm-hmm. Now, having been made a party, that doesn't mean he has to bring a claim, but he does have to be involved in the lawsuit if the issue is raised by somebody.
That's right. So he's now a party, and he doesn't ask for anything. So, and there are no other, are there any other two people, any people who can be claimants in this case? Just Clinton and Wendy?
I believe they're the only two.
Okay. So we got them both in the case, but Clinton is going to be silent.
Okay.
Right? So, and you think that's okay?
I think what?
And that is okay. You think that's okay to be sued, and you think that because Clinton is not going to benefit because Wendy is divorced, then they ought to recover from Allstate, or she ought to recover from Allstate.
I think it's okay for a husband not to sue his wife in a wrongful death case. I don't see anything illegal or immoral in that, taking that position. Okay, so maybe I missed the second half of the question.
Okay. You also think it's not collusive, but even if they're divorced, it may be to the husband's interest that Wendy be financially able. And one way of getting her financially able is to recover in this suit.
Well,
he pays maintenance there. Who knows what interests there are there?
So are you suggesting then that if a father opts not to sue his wife for wrongful death, mm-hmm. not wanting to do that, that that's collusion with the ex-wife? I'm a little confused.
Well, it might be.
Okay.
Why do you think a father has to be made a party to a wrongful death claim? That's what the law says.
Because it would be, that's to prevent the possibility of one parent simply moving forward, collecting the entire amount under the wrongful death statute, and then leaving the other person with no potential recovery.
So the recovery would be recovery for that one parent? I mean, if there are claims that can be severable.
They can be severed, but the...
Then why do both parents have to be part of the claim?
I think that just, I think that takes us pretty far beyond what the real issues are in this case, but I think the idea is that you don't want one parent to collect all of the money that's available under the statute, you know, go to Florida or whatever, and leave the other person in the dark before the statute runs with no claim. So it's a good idea to bring that person on board. Once they're on board in the lawsuit, then other issues that arise, whether they can even collect, they may be also negligent, they may not have any pecuniary losses, they may not have a relationship. I mean, these are all questions that would arise in individual cases.
Now, in a wrongful death claim that has $500,000 available to be divided here potentially between the mother and father, you still have to go back to court and prove what your damages are individually, don't you?
Yes, you do.
Okay, so it's potentially such that Wendy could prove her damages at just, say, $300,000. He could prove his at $200,000. What's to prevent her from collecting $300,000 from Allstate? He can't collect. I understand your argument on that, because he's an insured, but what's to prevent her from collecting, if she could prove it, $300,000?
Well, Allstate's arguing that their family member exclusion clause prevents her from collecting that money.
But she's not an insured.
Right.
She's not a member of the household.
Right. She's not, yeah, and there's no reasonable possibility of collusion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, and I think a narrow reading of the provision, that there's nothing to prevent her from recovering. She should recover.
Thank you.
But also note that the Clinton Day arrived in the lawsuit via his own insurance company joining him as a necessary party. Mm-hmm. In the event that the insurance company would become concerned that the mother would overcollect for damages, and that the insurance company would want to make sure that they don't overpay, they simply ask as a matter of cooperation that he assert his damages, even though he can't collect them, to prevent that from happening. They haven't done that. It's not like there's no recourse for the insurance company in that context.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sweetlick.
May it please the court. I
guess I'd like to start out by pointing out that I believe that allowing Wendy Day to maintain a claim despite the family member exclusion contained in the Allstate policy would, in fact, result in a reversal of the Whirlpool decision. The reason that I believe that is that we really have a very similar situation insofar as you have a non-insured bringing suit against an insured person based on bodily injury to another insured person. The difference is that, in our case, the insured person who sustained the bodily injury died. In the Whirlpool case, that person didn't die. And there have been some references to what's in the record and what's not in the record. I would point out that in this case, we followed the Mallory procedure and that there was very, very strong efforts to limit the ability to get into any questioning on the merits when the few depositions that were taken in this case were taken.
Counsel, I see the survivorship claim as akin to a Whirlpool, but I don't see the law, the individual claim, the separate and individual claim that can be brought under 895.043 as akin to Whirlpool for what's being sought. You know, in Whirlpool, it was the Whirlpool bringing an action to contribution to get at the damages to the child, for the child, right?
Right, I understand.
Yeah, this is just a claim for mom's loss of society and companionship, a separate and individual claim.
I understand that. And I think that we have to go back to the public policy that underlies the family member exclusion. I think if you look at Whirlpool, there's discussion of the possibility of collusion. And I think that just looking at this lawsuit, looking where it started and where it is right now, you can see that the possibility of collusion is much greater in this situation than it was even in Whirlpool. Because in Whirlpool, we already had a situation where the injured person's party was claim was settled, and there was a separate action that was brought for contribution. Here we had a complaint that initially included all kinds of allegations, included parties that have been dismissed who would invoke the family member exclusion. And I think, as the Court of Appeals points out, waiving claims so that you can avoid an exclusion, I think that that really is evidence of the type of collusion that the family member exclusion is designed to prevent.
Let's take a look, as we always must, at the language of the policy.
Okay.
And figure it in to the individual loss of society and companionship.
Okay.
Now, the mom can bring an individual loss of society and companionship, and she could bring a survivorship claim. Is that correct? Under 895.04, sub 3?
She can bring both those claims.
That's
under,
right.
Under 895.
Right.
Yes.
And a dad can bring an individual claim for loss of society and companionship and a survivorship claim, which covers the other injuries. Is that right? Okay. So with that in mind, let's take a look at the language of the policy that you're interested in and the exclusion. Do you have that in front of you, counsel, or do you have it committed to memory?
Yes.
On both counts.
We do not cover bodily injury to an insured person or property damage to property owned by an insured person whenever any benefit of this coverage would accrue directly or indirectly to an insured person.
Can you explain to me, advance your argument, as to how her individual claim, and in fact, since they're separated or divorced, here they're divorced, but the law or the procedure is if they're separated or divorced, they have their own lines on the verdict if both of them were bringing an individual claim for loss of society and companionship, so they're not co-mingled. So here we have, can you explain to me how the benefit on this individual loss of society and companionship claim would accrue directly or indirectly to an insured person? Can you advance that argument?
Sure. I think, first of all, to the extent that Clinton Day and Wendy Day have joint custody of the children, and Wendy Day would obtain a financial recovery, I think that there's a potential benefit to the children. If she has more money, she's got more money to spend on providing things like clothing and food and shelter and school supplies and things of that nature. I think that Clinton Day could even indirectly benefit insofar as perhaps his load of caring for these children could be decreased by virtue of the fact that she has a financial recovery in this case.
You mean it like child support or something? I mean, that's usually based on ability to pay.
Right.
The threshold determination anyway, you know, 17%, 25%, 29%.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that.
So that doesn't change.
Well, that may not change, but, you know, he may be doing more than he's required to do because Wendy doesn't have the financial wherewithal to do so. And the children would certainly.
I mean, I'm going to stretch your argument. Okay. Now that she's received, and I'll pick a number, let's say for her loss of society and companionship, I'm just going to pick a number, $300,000. And maybe with that $300,000, she's going to travel a bit. And then she won't be around to take care of the kids as much. Or she can take one of the kids on vacation with her when she travels. And so then that will inure to the benefit of a surviving sibling. And therefore, this exclusion should apply. Is that what your argument is? Surviving siblings might go on vacation with her or ride in a new car that she bought. Is that what it is?
If you're focusing just on the wrongful death claim, I would say that, yes, it's the public policy behind the exclusion, the potential for collusion.
I need help with this. For me, it's a disconnect. Why does the fear that she, because he's not going to get anything. They're divorced. This is a separate claim. He's entitled to nothing. How does the fear that maybe the kids will be able to go on a vacation or ride in a new car or when they're with her be in a larger apartment or house, how does that fit in to this, the policy behind the family collusion, you know, not trying to get around an exclusion surreptitiously? It just seems like a disconnect.
Your Honor, in addition to what I've said already, I would point to this New York case that's very recent that we cited in our brief, where when the court analyzed whether there was any benefit, that included defense and indemnity. And I know we have a direct action statute in Wisconsin in that the decision was made by the petitioner to dismiss Holly Day. But under that particular case, and that is a very recent case. That's a 2010 case.
Not our jurisdiction.
No, it isn't. It isn't. I acknowledge that. I acknowledge that. But I think that if you look at the language of the exclusion, and it talks about the second element, if you will, talks about any benefit of this coverage accruing directly or indirectly to an insured person, there certainly is no dispute that Holly Day is an insured person.
And so the argument, again, as it connects to, you got to remember what we're looking for, collusion, right?
Right.
The argument is the fact that the Holly, who's not the biological mother, the fact that Holly would be indemnified, she didn't need, because of the direct action, she wouldn't even need to be named, obviously. The fact that she would be indemnified under the terms of the policy gets you to think that that's a benefit that would lead to collusion.
It could lead to collusion. I mean, I think that, again, all the courts that have addressed this exclusion have talked about the policy behind it. And I think that, for example, if you look at a situation where Holly Day is left to defend herself and pay any judgment out of her own assets, as opposed to a situation where she's being defended and indemnified by Allstate, I think her incentive in terms of how she wants to approach the defense could easily be different.
Well, Counselor, I think you have, what, $300,000 coverage here, but doesn't wrongful death go to $500,000? That might give her a little incentive to defend herself.
That's true. That's true. I mean, it's $300,000 policy, and the statutory limit for a minor is $500,000.
That's right, $200,000 spread. That's a lot of money.
Well, it is a lot of money. I agree.
So you're thinking that she would, Holly would face exposure of $200,000 in order to collude with Wendy's getting $300,000. That's your one argument on collusion. And then your other argument on collusion is that the kids benefit because of, I don't know, vacations or a car or a better house or apartment, and that some way that benefit to the kids could cause collusion. That's where I'm missing, how you get to collusion.
I think there's other ways that you can get to collusion, too. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, if there's a deliberate waiver of a claim so that someone else can make a claim, I think that's collusion. That could be collusion. And we not only have Clinton Day apparently, and we don't even really know at this point, but apparently not looking to pursue his own claim, but the two minor children were plaintiffs. And they decided to dismiss their claims. And again, I think it's just because of what we're talking about right now. They wanted to set this up as just a wrongful death claim because of the differences that you're pointing out between a survivorship claim and a wrongful death claim. And for example,
survivorship is a wrongful death claim. Too.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's just two different kinds.
Right, right. But I think that, you know, when we look at this exclusion, and I think that's really what we must do in this case. The second element, I agree with counsel for the petitioner that the second element is the key here. What we have to do is we have to look at what benefit the coverage would accrue directly or indirectly to an insured person. Because I don't think there's any dispute that the bodily injury is to Emma Day, and that the first element then of the exclusion has been satisfied. And I think that we can go through the whole family one by one, and we can see that there is the potential for a benefit and a potential for collusion with regard to each of the family members.
Do kids have, I just don't know this and I should, do kids have the right to have an individual action for loss of society and companionship against a sibling?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I think it's just the parents who have the right.
I think that the complaint was for emotional distress, and I think that depending on the circumstances, and again, we weren't really allowed to get into that at the time we took the depositions, uh-huh. But depending on the circumstances, there could be an emotional distress claim for the children.
This is really a practical question, and I too should know the answer, but I don't. When you try a wrongful death claim and you have a mother and a father that are seeking damages and the limit's $500,000, is it that they are both separately on the jury verdict form and in the special verdict the jury has to award $250,000, or do they do $500,000, or how does it work?
I think it depends.
And then does the judge decide how it's divvied up, or how does that work? Or are they told your limit's $500,000?
Well, in my experience, it has depended upon whether the couple's married. If they're divorced, then generally I think that the verdict would be separated, where they would each have their own individual claim for damages, because arguably one of the parents might have had a closer relationship with the decedent than the other and might have a right to a greater recovery.
Okay, and if the limit's $500,000, is the jury told that? Or are they, can they say $1 million for each parent and then the judge?
I apologize, it's been a while, but I think there's a jury instruction that says they are told the limit.
Yeah. Okay, so then they know the total, it has to be split between those two somehow.
Yeah.
So in this case, they'd be told the total of $500,000 has to be split between Clinton and Wendy.
Well, I don't think they'd be told that $500,000 has to be split, but I think
could
they'd
be
told that
right.
$500,000 is the most.
Right.
Okay. And all right.
They could
so,
get less. Right.
So the then you would know.
Could be less. Yeah.
Depending on the relationship, they could get a lot less.
Okay. In Whirlpool, what was the indirect benefit that went to the family member?
That's why I would argue that the possibility of collusion in Whirlpool was much less than in this case, because the child had already recovered. And Whirlpool was suing for contribution, but the court had indicated in Whirlpool that the money could be funneled or would be funneled back to the child because of the fact that the child had already been paid, and that it basically approaching it the way they did was trying to get around the family exclusion when, in fact, this is...
Whirlpool would pay more than they settled for?
No, I don't think they could pay.
Okay, so how would it be funneled back to the family?
I think Whirlpool paid the claim, and then they wanted to get some or all of it back by suing the mother for negligent supervision. I don't think that they would have been entitled to make a claim for more than what they paid.
Right, but how does that money that they received get funneled to the family? Or was the court saying because their nest egg won't be quite as empty as it would have been?
I think what the court is saying, and I mean, really, they did say the money getting funneled back to the minor child, but I think what the court was saying was that you're putting form over substance here. You know, you knew that you couldn't sue her in the case that was brought by the daughter because of the family exclusion, and now you're trying to get around the family exclusion to get the money back that you already paid to the child.
To me, that case is a reach. How is that an indirect benefit to the family?
I think that just underlies the policy behind the family member exclusion, that this exclusion serves a legitimate purpose. That purpose is to prevent situations where family members would be inclined to provide an advantage to another family member because of the monetary recovery, and that because of that possibility of collusion, we're just going to assume collusion in all cases rather than looking at the cases on a case-by-case basis and making a factual determination on collusion in each case.
At the time in the facts of Whirlpool, they didn't pay out. They just brought a contribution claim. They hadn't paid out yet, had they?
I apologize if I'm remembering that wrong.
I'm asking. I don't know.
I thought they had paid out. Going back to where I was, looking at the second prong of the exclusion, which deals with a benefit accruing directly or indirectly to an insured person. I think with Clinton Day, we have the wrongful death claims. He's a beneficiary, wrongful death beneficiary under the wrongful death statute. He would be entitled to recover from the estate under the survivorship claim because the decedent was a minor and she was not legally capable of executing a will. And again, as I mentioned before, I believe that the fact that a monetary recovery by Wendy could benefit Clinton because of the joint custody situation, I believe that those are all indicia of benefits that go to an insured person that could result in collusion.
Counselor, I need to draw you back to Whirlpool a little bit more because for me it's the hardest case. In Whirlpool, the child couldn't sue the mother because of the family exclusion, and it was the claim of the child that was the focus, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then Whirlpool stepped in and they wanted to assert the claim of the child against the mother, so it was exactly the same claim, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In this case, unless I misunderstand, what Wendy is asserting is not the claim of her deceased daughter. It is her own claim, and that's different in my view from the claim. So it's in Whirlpool, both the claims were a claim of the insured. The child was an insured, and the claim Whirlpool brought was based on the claim of the insured. Here, Wendy's not an insured, and she's not bringing a claim on behalf of an insured.
Not anymore.
Beg your pardon?
I said she's not anymore.
Well, I thought she was bringing a separate and independent claim. That's what
we're
here about.
Well, her complaint included a survivorship claim. I think they just conceded in
one of the briefs. Oh, I see what you're saying.
In fact, the statute requires that,
right,
doesn't it?
I understand what you're saying. I just misinterpreted what you meant. We're really today simply dealing with whether she has an independent claim. And that's what I'm trying to line up with Whirlpool, is the independent claim, not the claim that also accrues under the wrongful death statute. The independent claim is based on her personal loss. It's not based on a claim of the insured, correct?
I think the difference between Whirlpool and our case is the death.
I think it's a different claim. I think in Whirlpool, there's a claim of an insured that's mounted by, or that could be mounted by, the child, could be mounted by the Whirlpool. It's the same claim. It's the claim of the child. And it's both cases, it's based on the claim of an insured. Where here, in this case, what Wendy's trying to proceed on is not the claim of an insured. It's the claim of a non-insured, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it's not based on any, it's not based in the same way.
Well, it derives from the death.
I understand that. I mean, but some parents have very little to do with their children. When they get divorced, they don't see their kids at all. I mean, we see that all the time in court. Other parents are totally involved with their children, whether they're married still or not married still. So, you know, this is a claim. And that's why you have to prove damages in wrongful death, correct? Because everybody doesn't have the same kind of relationship.
I agree.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm not sure I understand this case. When does Allstate have to pay out?
When does Allstate have to pay out? Well, there would have to be, if this decision of the Court of Appeals were reversed, the case would be remanded to the trial court, and then we would get into discovery about how the child died, for example. There have been allegations made about the conduct of Holly Day. We don't even know if that's true or not. There'd have to be a finding of liability on the part of Holly Day, and then I guess the jury would have to determine what the damages are for both Holly and Clinton Day. And I guess Clinton Day could waive his claim if he wants to. But then, assuming that that this court decides there's coverage and there's a finding of liability and there's damages that are awarded, then that's when Allstate would pay.
Okay. I mean, can there be any payout without a finding of liability?
Well, there could be a settlement.
Sure. But, I mean, isn't the policy based on liability?
Yeah, it's an occurrence policy, yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not getting...
Who would be primarily liable if it wasn't Holly Day?
Well, when the petitioner made the decision to change their complaint, they agreed that they weren't going to make a claim against Holly Day or Clinton Day, but that instead they were only going to proceed as a direct action against Allstate. The complaint itself doesn't contain any allegations that Clinton Day was responsible for this. I believe the complaint only alleges that Holly Day was responsible. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, can there be a payout under the policy unless somebody is liable?
If there is insurance coverage, but the person who's being sued is not liable, then I don't think they'd have to make a payment.
Right, there's no coverage.
But the person, if the person who is liable or who might be liable, you don't have to make them a party under direct action.
That's correct.
So the person who's liable, the person whose negligence is asserted, would have to be proved even though that person is not a party in the lawsuit. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
I don't know if that clarifies what you want, what you're driving at, Justice Brasso.
What I'm saying is that somebody who isn't insured has to have been deemed liable in order for the insurance company to pay out.
Right.
Or am I wrong?
You're right.
Okay, and so that would be true whether that person is named or not.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the verdict would have, if this case goes to trial, they're going to have to find that someone who's allowed to invoke the third-party coverage under the Allstate policy is liable in order for Allstate to have to pay under the direct action statute.
Well,
so as the pleadings are currently situated, Holly Day would have to be found to have been negligent, and that negligence would have had to have caused the death of the child in order for Allstate to be compelled to provide, make a payment in the event this court finds that there's insurance coverage available.
Well, if Holly Day had been named as a defendant and she'd been found liable, then she would have directly benefited in a sense by having the judgment paid.
Correct. And she was a party.
If she was never named, wouldn't there be a reason why she wasn't named?
Pardon me?
She wasn't ever named, there would probably be a reason she wasn't named, and that is that there's this policy out there. So she benefits indirectly.
I think that's even evidence of collusion. The fact that they sue Holly Day and then they dismiss Holly Day because of the direct action statute. I know they're entitled to do that in Wisconsin.
What I don't quite understand is if the language of the policy is absolutely clear, can some sort of public policy just wipe out that language?
I don't think so, and I think that Shannon and Whirlpool stand for that proposition. That's why I'm intrigued by the fact that the arguments that are being made essentially are that the public policy and ambiguity, because this very exclusion has been found to not be against public policy and to not be ambiguous. So I agree.
But first you have to come within the exclusion.
That's true.
And that's an interpretation of the policy.
I agree. Absolutely.
I'd like to return to Whirlpool because it, as I understand the facts, and I took a quick look, I don't find anything in here in another quick look that indicates that judgment, that Whirlpool had already paid off. I mean, oftentimes when you're defending a lawsuit, as a defendant, in the event that judgment is against me, then I have a claim of contribution against someone else.
Right.
And so you don't have to have paid out. You don't have to ask for indemnification or anything. I mean, so oftentimes you have a claim, in fact, in my limited experience, most often in my limited experience, a claim of contribution would be made before anything was paid out. And then you find out what you have to pay out, and then you see if your claim of contribution works. So as I'm going to assume, because I don't see it in here, that nothing was paid out by Whirlpool.
Okay.
And then if I make that assumption, this collusion is right in your face. That is, the daughter is injured. The daughter can't sue the mother.
Can't recover insurance proceeds, at least.
That's right. I mean, there's no need to sue the mother because there's no money. Okay.
Right.
It's a meat grinder made by Whirlpool. So Whirlpool, I think, without arguably, I'll read it more closely and you can point me to where I'm wrong. Whirlpool brought a separate claim for contribution. And it's like, okay, the daughter can't sue the mother, but we're going to sue the mother. And if we can get money for contribution from the mother, then that money can go to the daughter. I mean, that's what the court was concerned about, that what was happening is because of the exclusion, the daughter couldn't sue the mother, so we're going to have Whirlpool get money for contribution. And the more money they get for contribution, what's that based on? The mother being more negligent. So there's the incentive of the mother being more negligent to get more money for contribution to pay to the daughter because the daughter can't get the money from the mother herself. I mean, that just seems a pipeline going there.
Okay, I agree.
Yeah. Well, that kind of collusion is much more direct than
waiving claims?
Well, let's see what waiving claims is. I'm not sure about all this waiving claims stuff. I think each one is entitled to be on the verdict. And, I mean, I just don't know this. Each one is entitled to be on the verdict. I think each one is entitled to whatever the, there's a difference between claims and getting paid on insurance. I think each one is entitled to whatever the limit is, $350,000 or $500,000 in their claim. Now, that doesn't mean there's coverage for that.
Well, I don't think so. I think that they'd have to share the $500,000.
That's right. There's one recovery, $500,000 divided by either two or one or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
And I guess they just have to use a ratio if the money went over 500 to determine who would get what.
Well, there is a case, actually, that talks about that, which is a divorce case, and I'm sure you're probably already aware of it.
Not by
Keithley, yeah, K-E-I-T-H-L-E-Y, and there the mom got all of it, and the dad got zip because there wasn't a relationship. But it was, again, prove your damages, and then the court decided which how it would go. And in the course of the appeal up to the appellate courts was they didn't think the court made a proper division, but the case says, no, that's what the court does. They make that division. So.
Right. Thank you.
Ms. Hyde.
You may proceed.
In analyzing this case, I think it's important to keep in mind the two components of the analysis. One is an analysis that involves simply construction of the Allstate family member exclusion provision itself and whether it applies in this particular case. And that seems to hinge largely on the meaning of the word benefit and how that's going to be construed by this court. The second analysis, the issue of benefit doesn't really overlap with the issue of collusion. The issue of collusion is important because that is the rationale that's been used by past courts, and it's the only rationale that's been used to allow application of a family member exclusion provision. And Whirlpool, though its analysis was pretty stretched to the limit, did manage to find a potential for collusion in the facts. And every other case has found that in the context of a lawsuit that involves claims between two insured family members. This case, Allstate's stretching pretty hard to find some possibility of collusion. And I just want to mention that if there's collusion in this case and the collusion that can be identified in this case is sufficient to uphold the Allstate family member exclusion provision, then what's to stop the insurance company from saying we preclude coverage if we believe that under the circumstances of the case, the defendant will feel guilty about what they've done. So they might collude. Or it's a direct action claim, so they don't have any money at stake. So what's to stop them from colluding? What if their limits of the policy are sufficient to protect personal assets? Under those circumstances, we preclude coverage.
Counsel,
what if there's
laws
between friends?
Counsel.
I mean, it's just that it goes on forever.
Excuse me, counsel.
I'm sorry.
First of all, I'd like to point out that I have found the arguments of both counsel to be very illuminating during this oral argument.
Yes.
And something you said at the beginning of your rebuttal stuck out, and that is that if, in your estimation, a lot of this will come down to how this court ultimately construes the word benefit.
Correct.
And I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that, because your opposing counsel has suggested several ways in which an indirect benefit may accrue, and you kind of came close to it a minute ago. And now you're going through a list of hypotheticals, which might not be the most illuminating part of this oral argument.
Okay.
But your point is well made. What is your response to the requisite level of showing of benefit? I mean, the possibilities and potentials for indirect benefit have been listed in terms of a lessened spousal support or child support or maintenance. Also that the children may have a better standard of living because of some of the money. What would you suggest if you had the opportunity to draft the opinion in this case as the requisite showing of indirect benefit?
First of all, I would reject the notion that a benefit of indemnification is what this means, indemnification and defense. If that is the case, then the entire key phrase is rendered meaningless because there would be no purpose to it, because there's always a possibility of indemnification and defense anytime an insured is.
Right, I'm talking about the indirect benefits that have
been suggested. Yeah, that I don't think is what they mean here, and that's not what Whirlpool construed the term benefit to mean. I think the term benefit needs to be construed in the context of the public policy concern of collusion. So what extent of a benefit would be necessary to invoke to cause a legitimate serious concern of collusion commensurate with the kind of concern you would have when two insured people who are family members are suing each other. Otherwise, what they're asking for is kind of a ripple effect construction, so that if one of the children is going to get to supersize their meal at McDonald's, now they've been benefited and the clause kicks in. That's not what this clause means. It certainly shouldn't be construed so broadly that if any imaginable benefit could possibly come to somebody, then there's no coverage. What benefit has appeared to mean in past cases is the policy proceeds going to somebody. Just if Windy Day gets policy proceeds, that's the benefit.
Counsel, can I ask one thing quick? In Whirlpool, it says there was a stay of the product liability case. The manufacturer then sought the separate contribution suit. So is your understanding of the facts of that case that the underlying damages or case was settled and the amount that was going to be paid was determined, and then they were seeking contribution from the insurance company?
That's how I believe it came about in the Whirlpool case. I think the facts say that Whirlpool brought a separate action for contribution, and I read that to mean a separate lawsuit after the fact.
When Whirlpool settles or has a judgment against it to pay damages, the fact that it has a contribution claim doesn't add to the amount of damages that will be paid, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It just means that Whirlpool will not spend as much of its own money.
In this case, in the Whirlpool case, that's what it means. But I think
the
decision was looking beyond Whirlpool to a more common situation in contribution cases where it's all brought in one lawsuit, and where if the corporation did not have any money and couldn't pay up the full amount, then what would happen? And they were trying to create a decision that would cover all of these different situations involving contribution claims, not just the one at issue in Whirlpool.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I want to thank Ms. Height and Mr. Sweetlich for their arguments today relating to wrongful death, which has been a recurring issue in this court under a number of circumstances. And that ends our hearing on 08-AP-2929, Wendy M. Day versus Allstate Indemnity Company. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. That ends our oral argument for the month of January. We are adjourned.
Kevin, I'll be right back.